If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Canadians are simple folk. You guys made opiates the opiate of the masses. You just went right there. Very literal.
That's a good one. Yeah, we did. Well, no, I think we've made cannabis the opiate of the masses, but we're working on opioids now.
We're working on opioids.
Safe supply tablets. We're getting them young. We're getting them young. So the latest has been fentanyl tablets. So now there's new guidelines that came out in October, November from BC. Recommending fentanyl tablets. And that was what the paper last week for youth was about, was there are guidelines in the guidelines for these fentanyl tablets are, let's just call them directions for how to prescribe them to youth. And if you as a provider use your discretionary skills and experience and decide that this person in front of you would benefit from having this fentanyl tablets as a safer supply, you just need this, a second opinion from another doctor who could be your buddy down the hall. But okay. Either way, that's how you would then prescribe to a minor and that you don't have to speak to their parents. Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. It's snowing, oddly enough, and it's kind of sticking here. So we'll see how long it goes on. It's kind of a slushy snow. But it's
You're in the west somewhere, right? Are you west somewhere?
Yeah, I'm in the west somewhere. Western Washington.
Have you ever been to some of my good friends? Yes, I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been to many places, and that's one of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you travel?
Well, I've been to Ireland, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's that.
No, I do. I've traveled a lot. I've been to all the continents, including Antarctica. There's
wait, what?
Made an excellent story. It was like the first podcast I once did. I'll send you the link.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Did
you uncover any dark secrets of the elder gods or the government?
No, but you'll always uncover dark secrets if you go to sea.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
Yeah. Any ocean, the ship, people, there are always secrets that stay on ship. Yeah. It's another world. Yeah. Huh.
Do you recommend going seafaring?
Oh, definitely. Not Antarctica. I don't recommend Antarctica unless you're really, really physically agile, because that body of water is, you know, people compete about which body of water is the roughest body of water in the world. And some say it's somewhere in the North Sea, but the Drake Passage is kind of famous. It's the one that used to eat all the boats that were trying to get around the Cape Horn. Cape Horn. There's two capes, right? South Africa and South America. It's a rough ride, for especially because most of the people that go are people that can afford it, like elderly people. So lots of falls. Yeah.
Oh no, lots of broken hips.
Yeah. Well, and my broken neck, but that's for another day. Whoa, yeah, I'll send you the link.
Wow. Okay. Great. I'll have to plug that. Your adventures, Lori's adventures.
Don't. You don't need to plug it.
Okay. Fine.
But you know what I did is I don't know if you want to just launch, but I did make some notes because there's some stuff I'm afraid, like if I forget, I think they're really relevant things. I don't know if you want me to just sort of try to jump to them when we touch on them or. Yeah.
I love the launch. I'm into the launching. I guess the framework is just to introduce everyone to the situation and maybe through how you became informed of the situation and what the situation is. If you want to launch.
Sure. So I am an addiction physician. That means I'm a family physician who's done extra training in addiction medicine, primarily opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder. And I've been doing this about 12 years, and What that involves is a lot of prescribing long-acting opioids like methadone, and there's a newer one, buprenorphine. What's newer in North America? And it's really been the stalwart, sort of the main response that we've had to the opioid crisis. And when I was listening to Carrie, you talking to Carrie, and she gave you a really good history of the trajectory of what happened to us as physicians. So I think, like Carrie, I was in training in the late 90s when opioid prescribing was very
Blase.
laissez-faire. Yeah. And as a resident and as a new doc, I was often just filling in for somebody else and being asked, oh, yeah, the doc usually gives me 90 of those Oxy-80s. And I'd be, and that's a lot, like OxyContin, which is oxycodone. It's to me, it's like, in my opinion, it's oral heroin, because that's how people respond.
You just
Sorry. Yeah. All right. Sorry about that. That's was my phone. I have to disconnect it. Sorry. Yeah. So opioid prescribing was very, very loose. Just like on the show, there's a couple of good shows. The one in particular with Michael Keaton. I recommend to anybody who's interested in it.
Do you remember the name of that one?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Dope Sick.
Free and Clear? Dope
No,
Sick,
Dope
okay.
Sick. Dope Sick. So, yeah. So that was sort of the landscape, and Carrie described it really well. And being an eMERGE doc, she would have seen tons of it. I did a lot of eMERGE 20 years ago as well. So, you'd see people coming in, and they'd be in withdrawal, or they'd be talking about pain, and we didn't have any training to understand what was really going on. So fast forward another 10 years, and I started looking after people with opioid use disorder. And a lot of colleagues would say, oh, how can you do that? Drug seekers, which is just not a very nice way to describe somebody who's in withdrawal and is looking for an opioid to take away their withdrawal, because that's really it. So that's what I've been doing for 12 years. And then recently, not long before COVID, a new approach to the opioid crisis, because overdoses were climbing. And I'll get to the point that I think Carrie kind of referred to around 2012, there was a pullback on prescribing of oxycodone. So we basically exposed millions of people to opioids, sort of like a virus, sort of like COVID. We exposed all these people that wouldn't normally, like a 16-year-old getting knee surgery or something, or their tonsils out, or a 45-year-old having whatever, their shoulder put back in or something like that, like really routine stuff. We started prescribing Percocets, which are low dose of oxycodone, and Oxys for people that were longer la lasting, longer acting when they were still needing them for pain. Anyway, I think we generated a lot of what were called chronic pain patients. That's not to separate. That's separate from the fact that there are people with chronic pain, but we created a lot of chronic pain as well with that. And that some of that became addiction in the sense that people engaged in behaviors that may or ha have other consequences, like injecting, getting infections related to injecting, buying heroin on the street, and all of that.
So the could you just explain like the mechanism? Is it always the case, or to what extent is it the case that taking an opiate kicks the can down the road of pain? Like eventually I'm just it's is it just a trade-off mechanism? Like I'm robbing, Peter to pay Paul, right? Which is my future zero pain level to deal with the current pain level. I'm taking an opiate, but eventually I'm going to have to reacclimate
Deal
myself
with the
to,
pain?
yeah.
I mean, that's a great question. And n yes and no. So if you take an opioid for an acute pain, like you just get out of major surgery or you've just been in an accident, you've got all sorts of broken bones, You probably need an opioid. We give opioids to people to sed when they're under sedation while we do surgery. Like, there's lots of right places for opioids. And when somebody's in acute pain, you usually expect that to last a few days. And so a few days of opioid at just a moderate dose. I mean, we managed as a commu I mean, as a society with just codeine mostly for a long, long time. We had Tylenol threes. I'm sure you'd see some people get addicted to Tylenol threes, which is codeine, but you know, it wasn't until Percocets came along, Oxycosets, you guys call them Vicodin, and there's another name for it in the States, that we really started to see a ramping up of the scale, as Carrie said, the scale of people exposed and then developing a need for them. And you know, the bottles used to say take one every 4 or 1 to 2 every 4 hours as needed. And if someone wrote you a prescription for 100 or 50 or whatever, you would take them every 4 hours and then you would run out. And sometimes you might have dependence by then, and other times you might not,
Okay. So I
depending on your
just,
own genetics.
okay. Wow. Okay. So yeah. So we're talking about medicine and there's no one body. Everybody's got like kind of a different body with different tolerances for a variety of different interventions, let's say. But I'm trying to figure out, so once you get acclimated to regulating your pain through this pharmaceutical, your body's outsourcing the regulation of pain or getting tolerance. What's the difference between like a tolerance and a dependence? And
Good question.
why are opioids particularly dependably dependence inducing?
They're not the only ones. There are others. So benzodiazepines are another one. Opioids in particular, and this goes back a long, long time because, you know, opium use and poppies and heroin. Dependence is when you, if you don't have some amount every, let's just say 4 hours, or every day, or every 8 hours, whatever. It's usually every 4 hours. If you don't have a certain amount in your system, you start to feel withdrawal. And withdrawal is really horrible, and it's the beginning of horrible. So if you let it go farther and farther, you'll get worse and worse. This is if you're dependent. So you would develop like stomach cramping, flu-like symptoms, you'd be sweating, have goosebumps, you'd have diarrhea. I mean, you feel like you'd be vomiting. It's a terrible feeling. People look like they want to die, and they'll say that. They'll say, I want to die. I'd rather die than go through this. So you have to keep taking a certain amount, and that's dependence. But anyone can become dependent. If I'm dying of cancer and I have some terrible tumor in my system that's pressing on something and hurting me, the nurses will constantly come and give me an opioid to take that pain away. And taking it away means sort of like distancing you from it. You're aware of it, but you're not suffering from it intensely. Now, I'm not a pain specialist, but I do have, there's lots of overlap. That's dependence. Tolerance is when the same amount you took yesterday isn't holding anymore, isn't working for you, and you need more in order to just feel normal, to not feel sick. So neither of those things have to be addiction. And you or I could easily, if you stuck us in a hospital bed and gave us opioids regularly, which we do a lot with people, or we used to a lot more than we do now, we could develop those things. And the
So
best
in
way to get out of it is to be tapered down. So to You know, when your pain should be gone, let's say your wound is healed and you're still feeling like you're dependent, the way to get somebody off of it is to taper them down over as quickly as you can, usually initially.
Okay, so dependence and tolerance, there was this little tiny hint he gave me. Addiction is rooted in behavior, like seeking that. Dependence and tolerance is just purely the physiological dependence.
Correct,
Okay.
correct. And not everybody goes from that place to addiction. And I have another link for you I'll give you. It used to be in the National Geographic, but I'm just writing a note to myself here, which I really like. It's like a 4-minute video that I use for family doctors because Lots of primary care practitioners in Canada, that's mostly family doctors, don't really necessarily understand. So, anyway, so we're just to get to addiction, the actual behaviors of seeking, regardless of what the opioid is, seeking anything, whether you have to buy it off of somebody on a street corner or steal it from a store or whatever, or get into some sort of trouble, or maybe drive under the influence of it. All of those things are consequences. This is true for any addiction where it becomes a problem. It becomes a use disorder
Yeah,
where there are
which,
consequences.
yeah, it affects your behavior. You start to, it probably affects your relationships. It's probably all, like just a bundle of ways in which it starts to modify your behavior into a less, I guess, good, less than good citizen kind of thing. Like you're no longer able to.
I like when I'm teaching, I use the three C's, which I like, which is control, consequences, and needing control, consequences, and I'll think of the third one. There's actually four C's, but it's really lo losing a sense of control. Oh, and control, consequences, and I don't know, I'm drawing a blank, but I'll think of it when I'm not trying. But basically, it's sort of, it's a shift, and it doesn't happen in everybody. Many of us have been given opioids for something, like women are given opioids in labor, or you're given opioids if you have a kidney stone, or it's got its place. There's no question. But then, as has been described many times, pharma got their hands on it in a way and turned it into a little bit of a, I wonder if
Business
Carrie
interest.
mentioned Rat Party.
Oh, what's
This
that rat party? I never heard of this
video.
before.
It's a video. I'll give you the link to that soon.
Okay. Somebody links rat party.
There's a couple of them. Yeah, but they're helpful because we have to, and I really, we have to normalize and humanize addiction. I mean, we don't have to take the word away. That's another whole issue about terminology, and I wanted to get to that, but we really have to normalize and humanize it, just like we all have anxiety, and it depends on what we do with it, what we turn anxiety into. We can make it can become a disorder, or it can become, I don't know if you've ever heard that. I love this story. I don't even know if it's true or not. Some guy who's one of these guys who gives inspirational talks, someone, some goofy guy in a suit, was apparently sitting next to Bruce Springsteen on an airplane and said to Bruce Springsteen, "I love your shows, they're so great. How do you do it? Blah blah blah." And Springsteen said, "Oh, I wake up in the morning and I've got this energy in me, this tension, and then it washes over my whole body, and by that evening I'm just like ready to go." And he's very, it's very positive. And then I guess he apparently sat next to Joni Mitchell or Carole King or some folk singer who had stopped performing, and she said, "Oh, I just couldn't do those performances anymore. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd feel this energy in me, and it would cause this paralysis, and by the end of the day I couldn't function." And basically you're hearing, what's really a very basic human response to something, which is the release of adrenaline, being processed differently in two different people for all sorts of reasons. And this is kind of what can happen with withdrawal, with drug dependence, with alcohol dependence as well.
So
So a lot of emotions.
there's a romantic vision of the conscientious or virtuous drug user. The scene from Pulp Fiction comes to mind. John Travolta, he has heroin on occasion. Is that a myth? Is that a romantic fiction? Or are there people who this is a recreational thing, they're able to keep it in a box?
Funny that you ask that, because I do feel there are people kind of who often will come after me on Twitter, for example, who will say, and this is the one of the mottos of the activists in this area, is that people have a right to get high. Like, we have a right to use safely, which is, I absolutely agree. Like, you want to use something, you should be able to use a safe something. Just like I have a right to go buy safe alcohol, and now in Canada, I have a right to buy safe cannabis as well. It's kind of like, I think, Oregon. I don't know. Oregon, yeah. or out west anyway, Washington. So that is true, and that may be true that people can occasionally, I mean, I think it was, we think about what's his name, Ozymandias, Xanadu, Kubla Khan, Ancient
Coleridge.
Pleasure Dome, right. And, smoking opium. But the potency of what's on the streets now, which is fentanyl, and we have the same here as you have in the States, is so much more powerful that most patients will tell me that once they've used, and I have people I work with who have lived experience themselves who've recovered, and they'll say, no, once you have fentanyl, there's no going back and you can't stop. Like something has to stop you. It's very difficult. So I don't think we have the history because we've never in human history had fentanyl. It's a synthetic opioid, whereas heroin was, is an opiate from the poppy, extracted from the poppy. And technically speaking, it used to be our strongest opioid, and now it's not. Now it's a relatively weak opioid. So, yeah.
So, there's an overlap. You mentioned something about people on Twitter, maybe bagging on you for
For being
intruding,
against
yeah, for
this
being
harm
against
reduction
them.
strategy, yeah. Yeah.
I don't like the term defensiveness because that's always just like an assignation that somebody's being insecure. But there is like a slight insecurity if you need to defend your habit. And you find that a lot with any kind of discussion around pornography use. If you start to criticize pornography use, it kind of riles up a certain sort of defensiveness about it, pornography use. And if the person, I don't know, there's something telling about the defensiveness. Like there's a bond that has happened between you and this substance. It's your girlfriend. It's your, it's your love interest. It's something special
I
to you.
often
It's
tell
your
people it's your best
precious.
employer, your best employee. You can't just fire them. Like you'll be left, that's another one. Well, that works for alcohol a lot because when people stop using alcohol, it's actually kind of dangerous. That's another conversation, but it's
More
different than
dangerous
opioids.
than
Yes.
opiates. So
Yes.
opioids, the withdrawal symptoms that you were talking about were very dry, terrible feeling, but it doesn't seem like your body's shutting down. It's just going through a purgation process. Whereas alcohol dependence is another bag of kitty litter altogether.
Correct, correct. Yeah. And in fact, when I teach, because I teach a lot about this to colleagues and to residents, when I teach about it, I tell people the bottom line is that the withdrawal you want to watch for, the deadly ones are alcohol and benzos. Now, that's not saying that somebody couldn't die from some secondary cause of opioid withdrawal. They might have a seizure because they have a low seizure threshold, or they might
Their
get
immune system might be wrecked
dehydrated
and
if they're not supported. Well, yeah, more like a dehydration or something like that. But and they're miserable. Like it's not nice. It's torture, but it's not dangerous.
So you brought up two terms that are problematic, including the term problematic, which is the my problematic term that I'm going to apply to your two terms just to see how they shake out. You said normalize and humanize. To normalize can be taken too far, in my opinion, where just anything goes. There are no standards. There is a certain usefulness in public shaming to regulate other people's behavior and to warn people from going down those paths, right? But to normalize and to humanize can also be smartly applied for somebody who's suffering this and the people that are connected to the person suffering, let's say from addiction, to understand the mechanisms of it and maybe even anthropomorphize a little bit, like you were just doing with this is your best employee. This is something that works for you now. And in order to get free from them, it might help to, recognize that there is a deep bond that has happened between you and this habit or this substance, right? Is that by normalize and humanize, could you just expand on what you mean by those and the parameters of that?
I guess because there's sort of, the one end of the spectrum, I guess, is the stigma. So to the point where you might have an elderly person, let's say my parents, one of them was being treated for something and was given some hydromorphone, which is dilaudid, which is an opioid, and wouldn't take it. because they don't want to get addicted. The same thing happened. I remember my grandmother was given something and wouldn't take it. So there's that. So the fact that someone has pain in response to this, or that they get addicted and they need to seek help, if they're afraid to do that because they think there's something wrong with them, I guess that's more what I mean by
Okay.
normalize and humanize.
Okay.
Normalize, I absolutely get why that's problematic, because normalizing is what we're seeing with opioids generally.
Okay.
No, yes, a minor should be able to access them now. And in BC, you don't need your parents' consent to get fentanyl tablets. You just need two doctors to agree to it. So that was last week's headlines, was that youth would be able to access. I already knew that youth are probably accessing opioids in BC and probably in Ontario as well, quite easily through these programs.
Okay.
And that, to me, the normalizing of opioids is different than the normalizing of human processes that don't
Okay.
always feel right or that we stigmatize.
Okay.
So that's
All
more
right.
what I meant.
Yeah, thanks for
Yeah.
clarifying that. Are there particularly acute issues from your perspective or from the research that you've read and the experience that you've had with youth being exposed to opioids? Is it and is it
Yeah.
just mostly around self-control? They're just not developed enough to be able to distinguish. Do they have any do they like rewire your neurotransmitters or anything like
Frontal
that?
lobe,
They're
prefrontal
just
cortex,
idiots.
like decision making. Risk taking. So I actually happen to work in a youth detention center. So I work with a lot of young boys between 12, 13, and 19, that are incarcerated for usually for fairly serious crimes. And I've had patients, well, I call them patients, but I've had boys come in and they'll tell me they've been using what we call D8s or Dillies, which is dilaudid 8 milligram tablets, which are the safe supply kind of instrument right now. And I'll say to
Dilaudid,
them,
is that like a nasal spray or something? What is
no,
that?
dilaudid's a pill.
Okay.
It's a tablet. Hydromorphone. I don't know what you guys call it. You have hydrocodone as well. It's a strong opioid. So 8 milligrams is the strongest short acting form of hydromorphone you can get.
Okay.
And that's actually the number one right now, the number one tool in most of Canada for what they're calling safer supply, or safe supply, safer supply,
Okay.
is dilaudid 8 milligram tablets. And people are on these programs are getting 30 to 40 a day
A
of 8 milligram
day.
tablets. Yeah. So
How
that's,
long, how fast acting are these? Like 8 minutes or something like that?
Well, it depends on how you take them. If you swallow them versus if you crush them, cook them, and inject them. The idea is people are usually given kits for cooking them and injecting them, like so they do it all clean, and instructions on how to do that. And interestingly, the name brand are one of the preferred. So Dilaudid is the name brand, sort of like
Okay.
Kleenex, not tissue, and not hydromorphone like APO or whatever. And the name brand Dilaudid is made by Purdue. They made
Which is,
OxyContin.
they're the ones who actually
They're the ones that got into a
lobbied.
lot of trouble. Yeah.
Yeah, and that I'll refer people back to my conversation with Carrie Mendoza because it was that company working in conjunction with regulatory bodies that opened up the market, explored the
Correct.
markets,
In North
exploited the market.
America.
Okay.
Because that's the other thing, is it's you this whole phenomenon is unique to North America.
Okay. Because of
If you
just
go
the
to
way the
Europe,
business
there's
works
no
here.
fentanyl really, a not significant amount. Because the way business and science or medicine interact
Okay.
in North
Yeah.
America, yeah,
There's so
particularly in the
many.
States.
There's so many branches to this conversation. So I just want to kind of concentrate a little bit more on the youth, like dealing with youth with this substance, relationship to the substance. Like, what are the particular issues that they have, and then also the particular skills that you give them to deal with this? Like, is there a way to help
Okay.
them that's unique to them?
Well, first of all, what I was going to say about the dilaudid 8s is that I see a fair number of boys coming in who will say, yes, I have used them, or I use them with my friends, or I do. And when I say, where do you get them? They'll say, oh, from the van in St. Catharines or the mobile van or whatever. And they know what to say to get them. So they go and they say, well, me and my friends, we've both overdosed 3 times in the last 6 months, and we need naloxone kits and some safe supply tablets. And so that they get them. And then they generally either fool around with them themselves. They usually take them by mouth when they're younger, unless they're more experienced, or they might sell them because they're getting them for free. And then they might sell them for money, depending on their financial situation. So the consequences, but they're pretty young. They're pretty new to drugs. There isn't a lot of education. Lots of them aren't going to school. I was just listening to a podcast this morning about, is school kind of redundant or obsolete? And they don't really know one drug from another, so they might take something. Like they'll take Xanax, for example, which is a benzodiazepine, a whole bunch of it, like, I don't know, 12 to 16 times what you would take would be given for a episode of anxiety or a panic attack, maybe, or something like that. It's not, and it's, or it's illicit Xanax, so it comes in what's called bars. When I say bars to them, they look at me and they know that's not the usual prescription pills. But they'll take this stuff and they'll take one thing, then they'll take another thing, and then they might drink and they might do lots and lots of weed, and they'll mix stuff up. But if they get something really potent, like if they get a bunch of 8 milligram dilaudid tablets and they're not used to, they don't have tolerance to opioids from having taken it every day, they can overdose. And there have been some cases now. In the ones that have been recorded were in British Columbia. There's probably others. I don't know. I don't follow all the coroner's reports from all the provinces. We do keep track of, not for youth in particular, and I don't even know if we, I mean, we do follow a lot of the details of coroner's reports. It's not funny, I know, but I'm, I don't, you can't follow everything. But, I think they're getting better at tracking and reporting more of the details because there's a demand.
And do you see the youth culture getting better at recognizing when something's, dangerous, lethal?
No. I can't speak. I can only speak to the youth culture I've seen, which is mostly the ones that are on the street more.
Okay.
And the ones that are maybe in and out of foster care, they don't have, a solid home. Those are the ones that the kids that tend to end up incarcerated. Yeah. So I definitely am seeing, a skewed population, but, apparently, according to one of our journalists, that's Adam Zivo, I was mentioning the headline today. He went around Vancouver Island, which is off the coast of Vancouver, interviewing kids at high schools and asking them, asking them whether they get DILIs or D8s, which are these hydromorphone 8 milligram tablets, and how easy is it, and where do you get them from, and that kind of thing, getting a bit of a picture of that. And he's written about it, and I can give you
Yeah,
link to it.
The links will be in the description. Could you just, for the layman like me, explain the mechanism of overdosing and why you would overdose if you just ramped up your intake of this, whereas if you didn't, your body would be able to process it? Well, like, what are the mechanisms of just overdosing? Your body just stops breathing, I guess, right?
Yeah, so, keeping it simple, if I were to, or you, like if we were not tolerant people and we were to suddenly take, I mean, I don't know if 8 milligrams of hydromorphone would overdose me, but it might because it's pretty strong and I don't have opioids in my body. What happens is it slows down the automatic breathing center in your brain and in your middle of your brain. It's sort of the lower part of your brain that controls your breathing, especially when you go to sleep. So actually anybody on a high dose of opioids could, technically overdose, but they're less likely to because they have tolerance. So someone who's not tolerant and takes whatever that threshold amount is for that person, they could just simply stop breathing. They go into a very deep sleep and then they stop breathing. So
So they
they're
just
heavily
chill the
sedated.
fuck out. Pardon my French. They just totally chill.
Well, yeah, and this is what often people start to seek, is they want to chill, and maybe they have lots of things to be running from, lots of, places in their life that are unhappy. And a lot of people describe the first time they took an oxy as a warm hug.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of people describe. It was like a big warm hug, and they just keep seeking that again and again, and then they get into the cycle. It's part of what we call the reward pathway gets kicks in, and it gets really hard to interrupt that reward pathway. And then it takes more and more opioid. But at the lower threshold, or at the lower at a point of intolerance, what we call when someone's opioid naive, they are much more at risk of overdosing
Okay.
on what to another person might not even touch them.
And
So
how's that
someone who's using
different?
fentanyl, sorry,
No,
someone
I'm
who's
sorry.
using fentanyl is used to a really potent opioids, hydromorphone or Dilaudids, eights. They say, well, they don't touch me.
Okay. Is there a path off of fentanyl? Is there an off ramp to that? Or is it just like such a catapult that there's no way to, other
Yeah,
than
there is.
trampoline? Yeah.
There are. So the off ramp to any opioid, and I mean, this is my educated opinion, is long-acting opioid treatment. So opioid agonist treatment, OAT, we call it. In the States, they call it MOUD, or medical opioid. I don't remember what it stands for in the States, but opioid agonist treatment is kind of common vernacular, and it's usually methadone or buprenorphine. So those are two long-acting opioids. There's also one called Kadian, which is a long-acting morphine, which we're starting to use more. We just rewrote some guidelines a couple of years ago for treating op people who use fentanyl. So it's new. It's consensus guidelines. So that means they weren't based on systematic reviews. They were based on a consensus of experts
Okay.
going through all of the literature and reviewing current knowledge about tr how best to treat people who use fentanyl. And it's methadone or buprenorphine. So
And
it's basically, those are opioids, but they're long-acting opioids. You need to take them only once a day.
okay. And is it Cadian as in circadian or Canadian?
No.
It's some sort of Canada
K with
pun.
a K.
Okay.
No, it's with a K. I don't know why it's called Kadian.
Okay,
I
just
mean, it's a
wondering.
trade name. So,
Yeah.
but it's morphine, but it's a particular form in a capsule that takes about apparently 24 hours to go through the system. And we're not sure yet. I mean, I'm cautious because we don't have enough evidence to say this is a good, but it is, we're considering it third line.
Third
So those
line.
are, well, after methadone and buprenorphine. So those two are, we just have more, it's always based on science, like data. So we
Yeah.
have lots of data on methadone. We've been looking at methadone for 60 years. We have data going back 60 years. So we know for heroin treatment that it's a good replacement. And that allows people to get on with other things because they're not chasing the dragon all day
Oh, yeah.
long.
Okay, it opens up the room where they're not getting that hug. They have a little bit more space, but the hug isn't like gone.
Yeah.
So they're okay in their
Yeah,
cushy
some
little
people
room.
will say they do get it. Yeah, they shouldn't. Most people will say they don't. Those who function and are able to then function, there's more than just the treatment, though. Like, there's also what you might call it wraparound psychosocial supports. So, counseling people, getting them into a group, helping them get maybe finish high school and get into work, like all those other really important things, making sure they're getting housed. Housing is probably the biggest piece of the pie when it comes to what's going to determine somebody's, recovery trajectory. Having a stable place to live that's secure and is away from where they can kind of close the door and shut out all those other people, including their dealer and their ex who uses or sells or whatever.
So the
Culture.
methadone or these different rails or path chemicals. They deal with the dependence and the tolerance, but
Right.
Addiction is also about behavior, and so you need some a phalanx of treatments for the behavior as well.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And the ideal treatment program, which in my opinion doesn't quite exist, but we're working on it, is one that does address everything at once. It doesn't just. So, Ontario, notoriously, our province for the last 30 years or at least 20 years, has made it easy to access methadone. But it also, the treatment programs have been kind of monetized so that it became about volume. And so some of these clinics, many of the clinics, when I first came into practice doing this 10 years ago, most of the clinics were simply like churning people through, writing prescriptions for methadone, giving them their prescription. They go to the pharmacy every day. They're on a kind of a treadmill. They might have to come to the clinic twice a week. And there wasn't really much else offered for them. And so people were kind of stuck, like, oh, now I'm stuck on methadone forever.
Okay.
You know, and they didn't like that, and I don't blame them. So, although, but it's still an important tool in the toolbox, but it's now being called colonial and patriarchal and oppressive to
Oh, good.
prescribe methadone.
Oh,
Yeah,
really? Oh, because
fits
of
right in there.
gatekeeping. Yeah, okay.
Well, no, because people have to go to the pharmacy every day when they're not stable. Because you don't want them to be taking too much at once because they're, you know, feeling desperate. Like those behavior things, when the behavior things aren't sorted through a bit and things are still unstable and they're still injecting, they have to go to the pharmacy every day. Once they get a job and they're busy with important other things, then they can have what we call take-home doses. But with methadone, realistically, most people can get maybe a week or two. They still have to go to the pharmacy and have what we call an observed dose. That's still considered to be patriarchal and all of that. And
Because it's
so they don't
determining their
love it.
behavior. It's telling people what they can and cannot
It's
do.
giving them some structure, though, like early
Yeah.
on when they need it. And a lot of my patients will say that they needed it, they wanted that, and now it's worked for them. That being said, the other drug, which is buprenorphine, we won't get into how it all works, but buprenorphine is a safer drug to be able to give people take home. So usually, and it's more of a blocker. So when they take buprenorphine, they don't crave, they don't want to use, and if they do use something, it doesn't work. So
Okay.
it's much more of a hard wall, whereas methadone you can use on top of it and still maybe get high.
Okay. And that buprenorphine, what are the psychological, in your experience, the psychological effects of just not having that friend around anymore? Like,
Depends on where they're at. Like, if people are ready for that, they're really, really happy and grateful. They're like, oh, I almost lost my job, or I almost lost my wife, or I almost lost custody of my kids, and now that's not going to happen. So, if you can get it early, it's great. And they want that. But if you get people when they've been unhoused, they've been living in a tent, they've been using all sorts of different substances, trying to get through the night by staying up using stimulants and then whatever else. Once things have really all the wheels have fallen off the wagon, it's a lot harder for them to get back to something. So way more challenging.
Okay. So to kind of start to angle toward safe supply and the nuances and where you shake out on this program and what it is and why it is, what I'm picking up from what you're been telling me, and hopefully I'm a quick enough study for this, there's short acting and there's long acting. And short acting are more, not just dangerous as in deadly, but they're more powerful. They tend to be. That's where addiction kind of springs from, these short acting. Long acting are a little bit safer, and they are the off ramp to the short acting one. Why is that the case? It's pretty obvious the difference between crack and cocaine is crack. You like get it all at once. Cocaine, you have to kind of sit around and enjoy it, you know. But with the short acting versus long acting, the short acting are more dangerous and variety of ways. And is Safe Supply offering short acting rather than long acting? And is that one of the reasons that you're wary of it, if you are wary of that?
Yeah, so Safe Supply is short acting opioids. Somebody will readily challenge me and say, well, but some Safe Supply programs offer methadone, which is great. However, once you get people up to, so there's all sorts of tricks to methadone. Methadone, you really have to have experience and you have to get skills and some training to prescribe it. It's not a simple drug. It has all sorts of metabolic idiosyncrasies. Huh. So, but when methadone's offered with Safer Supply, that's really what it should have been in the first place. It's like, you know what? You're using, we get it. You need something short acting because the methadone is going to take 2 weeks to get you comfortable. Because that's how long it takes about to get people to a dose where they're going to be more comfortable and want to stop using. Then you could say, and this is how we originally conceived of Safe Supply, I suppose, although it meant other things as well. The language has been very conflated. But originally the idea was to give people something for a brief period of time, or what they call bridging, while you're getting them to a therapeutic level of a treatment, and then you would be able to stop that because they wouldn't need it anymore. The cravings would go away and so on.
Yeah. But it's not being used. And why or how did it shift, this Safe Supply program? Where did it come from? When did it start and how has it changed?
Well, like I said, there were ideas and talk about, there was the odd time where I would prescribe a shorter acting opioid to someone. If I go back 15 years, you know, it's going to get this person to keep coming back and we'll get them into treatment. And for the next couple of weeks, we'll have a plan, but they have to go to the pharmacy every day because I don't want them to sell them and, you know, whatever. So originally the idea was that it's a bridging, a way to engage patients. What it's become is its own thing. It's a right. A right to having clean opioids. I have a right to clean, to a safe supply. So it sounds really safe. It sounds really nice, a safer supply,
unless
you know,
you
than safer
surface,
than
yeah.
fentanyl. But the reality is anybody I have seen as a patient who's used fentanyl says, no, the hydromorphone doesn't work. It's not strong enough. And they laugh and they say, everybody knows that the people that get those pills are selling them.
Okay.
And if you sell them in the city, you might only get 50 cents or a dollar for the tablet. But if somebody buys them in bulk and drives them to a more remote community, you can get $20 or $25 a tablet. So that's quite the markup from wholesale to retail. And I see people, I also work in the Northwest Territories. So that's sort of up, sort of same as Alaska. And up there, there's a point where people can drive from BC. They can get the prescriptions in BC where the program is really quite wide, broad, and they can drive up into Northwest Territories and again, sell these tablets for quite a bit more. And I work in the jail in Yellowknife and sometimes people actually get arrested and end up in the jail in Yellowknife for doing that. But okay. That's how this is actually working. But I'm being called all sorts of names for calling that out.
Okay.
You know, and not just me. Like I have a group of colleagues who are all in the same boat.
So there is, this is the interesting, this is where the politics come into play and activists and this language around rights and where are these rights coming from? We don't have to get terribly philosophical, but there's a zeitgeist around give the people what they want. And there's activists, and then there's medical professionals who are very permissive with this and who are, I'm sure, trying to act in good faith and compassionately to curb suffering. The weird thing about the moment, this moment, or the modern era, let's just say, with medicine, that which cures suffering is also causing suffering. There's a trade-off there. Like if it weren't for the pharma, we didn't have this suffering, but the pharma was created to end suffering. So what do we do with human suffering? What is the proper relationship to suffering? It can't be just relieve it, end it. There's a place for suffering. right? With regard to who a, how a human being lives their life, you know, and this is kind of more a philosophical stance that should precede, or there's going to be a philosophy that's motivating or that's activating people trying to give people what they want, and people saying, "Wait, hold on, let's think this thing through." And what we see, there's some sort of crossover with maids here, with medical assistance in dying.
I say that all the time.
There's something about Canada, the philosophy that's animating Canada's healthcare, that is giving people whatever they want, including death and addiction,
and
right?
Puberty blockers
and puberty,
sex hormones and mastectomies, yeah. And let's see what else. And then other. So the Safer Supply is not just opioids. They're also giving out benzos and stimulants. So you could get Ritalin if you wanted it. You pretty well can ask for what you want.
Okay. And what is the virtue of the people who are giving anyone, including minors, access to powerful medications that are being used recreationally?
Well, as you said, they mean the best. They're compassionate. They want to do the right thing. And they also want to be appreciated and loved. There's a lot of social currency to doing this as well. But they believe the mantra that this is saving lives. So this may sound familiar, but this is life-saving treatment.
Okay.
And if you do anything to withhold it or to try to sort of interfere with providing it to the public, then I've had hashtag genocide and hashtag eugenics.
Oh.
Because we're somehow trying to get rid of people who use drugs because we are against this life-saving treatment.
Okay.
That's the narrative.
Is it life-saving or lifestyle preserving? That's the conflation, right?
That was a rhetorical question, right?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to assess, because it is a rhetorical battle on some level. The people who, it seems like Canada is just going to be permissive as all get up, because that's just the path that they've taken. Is there mounting evidence that this life-saving treatment, so-called, is actually life-curbing, life-destroying, life-ending? And was that how you changed the discussion, or is that how the attitude changes over time? Do you see that happening?
I actually don't see science and evidence that exists or that we're going to have being believers or being the, the sway, creating the sway, because a lot of money, so a lot of federal money has flowed over $100 million in the last, 2 to 3 years, has flowed into these programs, which are now publicizing and doing their research. So almost all of the research they're doing is qualitative. What I call customer satisfaction surveys.
Okay.
That are getting published in peer-reviewed journals. There have been a couple of, I guess you could call them objective, inferential studies where they've looked at prescriptions and said, all of the people that received this particular prescription, which we're assuming was a Safe Supply prescription, they used the emergency departments less and they had fewer deaths. And I don't even know if they were able to show that they had fewer deaths, but they are able to sort of say, these are a big win. And that gets hyperbolized, like blown up in, like there was a paper,
yeah,
I think it was a week ago, like this, that really had a lot of confusing, okay. it had a lot of confusing confounders, and our mainstream media is the CBC and the Globe and Mail. And they were all about how this is a landmark, I think was the quote. This is a landmark study. It really like I said, hyperbolic, really blowing it out of proportion, and these, and often not really accounting for other internal factors, like the fact that half of those people were also on methadone, which we've known for a couple of years now, quite a few, that being on methadone, remember what I said about your tolerance? Like if your tolerance is maintained, let's say you're not ready to give up opioids, but you want to get back to work, you want your kids visiting you, let's say you're starting to make changes and you're on methadone and you're doing well and you're not using fentanyl, or maybe you're using it once in a while when you run into somebody or whatever. The fact that you're on that methadone, let's say 100 milligrams a day, maintains that respiratory tolerance so that if you then go and use fentanyl, you're less likely to overdose. So there was a very nice study. There's a couple, but there was one in particular out of Rhode Island where they showed that when they followed people who were on versus off methadone, who were using fentanyl, they knew they were using fentanyl. They followed people who were on it and people who are off it. And the only overdose deaths that occurred over the 1 year period were the ones who were either not on it or had come off of it and weren't taking the methadone.
Okay.
And that's like that points to it being protective. And the same with buprenorphine. We have early studies on buprenorphine that point to the same thing, but we think with buprenorphine, we need to go along with, we're just getting used to it as a drug, as a treatment. So we're still kind of figuring out what people need to get off fentanyl because it's a bit trickier.
Okay.
But it's that tolerance. It's that tolerance that's protecting people from overdosing. And so to go and measure people and say, oh, these people received a hydromorphone prescription and these people didn't, and less of these people died than those people, but half of them were on methadone as well, and not to account for the methadone, that kind of thing. Just very loosey-goosey, as you said, a bit shoddy in the methodology.
Canadians are simple folk. You guys made opiates the opiate of the masses. Just went right there. Very literal.
That's a good one. Yeah, we did. Well, no, I think we've made cannabis the opiate of the masses, but we're working on opioids now. Save
Opiates.
some fine tablets. We're getting them young. We're getting them young. So the latest has been fentanyl tablets. So now there's new guidelines that came out in October, November from BC recommending fentanyl tablets. And that was what the paper last week for youth was about, was there are guidelines in the guidelines for these fentanyl tablets are, let's just call them directions for how to prescribe them to youth. And if you as a provider use your discretionary skills and experience and decide that this person in front of you would benefit from having this fentanyl tablets as a safer supply, you just need this a second opinion from another doctor who could be your buddy down the hall. But
Okay.
either way, that's how you would then prescribe to a minor and that you don't have to speak to their parents.
Okay. What's wrong with fentanyl?
It's way more potent than
Do
all
you know
of
where
the
it comes from?
others. It's
Do you have
synthetic,
idea?
so
Okay.
you would make it in a lab. Do you mean what country? Or because I
I
think
just like
it's
kind of what it's derived from and why is it the cat's meow?
I'm not a organic
Okay, that's
chemist,
fine.
but it's the cat's meow because it's much more potent. Now we've been using fentanyl for decades for anesthesia. It's very, very powerful. It's very short acting. And I used to put people to sleep for brief periods of time to do a minor procedure or put their shoulder back in or something, and they would get fentanyl and midazolam, which is a benzodiazepine in a combination IV, but you have complete control over their airway while they're getting that, so that you're giving them oxygen, they're breathing, that's what it was for in the first place. It's also used as a radio label in animals for some of the, so carfentanil, which is one of the ones, it's maybe sometimes it makes it onto the news because it's one of the killer, really super potent opioids. Carfentanil is used as a radio label carfentanil to identify opioid receptors in the brain on scans. So you can look at a scan, and if you look up, I can't remember what it is, what the
It
radio
lights it up
label is,
somehow.
that, yeah. And you can show actually with, there's a medication where you can show. So one of the buprenorphine, you can show that as the dose goes up of the buprenorphine, you see less and less of the carfentanil binding to the brain, the, you know, parts of the brain. So it's kind of like showing that the buprenorphine keeps the carfentanil from binding, which is an indirect idea or evidence that it's preventing the fentanyl from binding. And we see it in person as well. You can show that in person by giving people the blocking medication and then giving them an opioid, and they describe how good the opioid felt, or they'll give it a score out of, I think, 5 or 10, and they'll score it lower if they're on an adequate dose of this medication. And when people want to do that, like when they want to get well, this is the other part, though, that drives me crazy about this, is this harm reduction conversation has become really big. Everybody's harm, it's all about harm reduction.
Yeah.
And nobody gets to get well. Nobody has the opportunity for recovery. It's like everybody's been palliated.
It those words, harm reduction.
Who's going to argue?
Well, again, it goes back to, I mean, it's the treadmill to microaggressions. Like everybody's just seeing harm everywhere. Or it's another way. It's just. It doesn't seem, from a psychological or philosophical standpoint, beneficial to the individual to seek to reduce harm in themselves or to reduce suffering, to flee from suffering. Like it's that whole argument around anti-fragility, right? Like it's inculcating fragility. Harm reduction is taking the responsibility out of the hands of the individual and then offloading it onto the state. That's where the right, that's the where the weird trick of rights comes from. It's like, oh no, the state, big daddy or big mommy state is going to deliver me from working on my life.
Well, so harm reduction, if I go back to when I was in medical school in the early 90s, harm reduction at that time, if you can imagine, HIV was like the scourge, right?
Okay.
And harm reduction was about handing out clean needles so people didn't share them, or handing out condoms so people didn't have unprotected sex, so they didn't give each other HIV. So there is meaning in it. But it's become something else now. Now it's become much more philosophically warped.
Yeah.
And the idea is that we're protecting or somehow saving lives by giving people this clean drug that they can then cook and inject. And I didn't mention it, but seeing the consequences of the injection, like I always tell people when I'm teaching that the goal should really be. And I tell patients this. I feel like I teach patients, but what I teach them is the goal should be to get you injecting less often, because every time you inject, it's an opportunity for a heart infection or a spinal cord infection or, you know, or bloodstream infection. And the less injecting and the more they're taking an oral opioid agonist, like a long-acting agonist, the less injecting they're going to do. And that's a start. That's harm reduction. That's
Okay.
reasonable.
Yeah. Well, so I think it goes back to what you're saying about like a fully and holistic, maybe you didn't use that term, but that's one term that's a holistic view that's rooted in what a person is rather than just a bag of needs that we're going to gratify or pains that we're going to reduce in some way. You're seeing a human being as a volitional agent who has choices and who can have a better or worse life, who can have a broader or more narrow life. And you see that, or it's probably the case that the addict who is seeking help is seeing that their life is becoming all about that one thing. And they're like, wait, no, life should be going in this direction, but it's going in this direction. And so with that viewpoint of time and of just a broader sense of what it is to be a human being, you can guide them or you can develop a protocol or a therapy or a therapeutic phalanx that can help them with their life rather than this harm reduction model or this public health model. When I hear it being described, when you even just you describe it, it's like just these random people doing random things, just, you know, fucking each other with or without condoms, or just shooting up or not shooting up. There's not really, I don't get a sense of anybody thinking about the individual. It's like my son is doing this and I'm going to treat this person like they're a human being. It's just like they're, it's already kind of dehumanizing. Like this heart, just the way that it's conceived of or the way that's communicated. It's just like there's these people who are going to do this thing no matter what, and we can't really stop them. It's not our job to stop them. So we should just make it easier as possible and less less dangerous for the public health to tweak these little things, to have these little interventions. But it doesn't seem like you're caring for a human being. You're just caring for some sort of image. It just does. It's not convincing to me. I don't know if I'm even.
Well, it's also not. Yeah. Well, you are talking about how we look at the individual patient and also, but the population.
Yeah.
We also, my argument around the safe supply, I like to call it tablet programs, because to me, that's what they are. It's just tablet programs. But, and somebody calls them PSAD or SAD, which means supply of addictive drugs, which I think is kind of. Apropos. But we're also not looking at outside the circle of this population that's been designated as, you know, having special rights because they're marginalized and they've been stigmatized and they use drugs and all of that. But that's the population around them, which is the community. The real public health is about the whole population, which is about how many more people are able to then get access to an opioid that didn't before. So we're kind of repeating what we did 20 years ago with oxycodone. We're just making it liberally available. And the push is to keep expanding. If you read some of the, you know, articles, it's to promote expansion of these life-saving programs.
And that, there's the, and why that is the case is a systemic issue. Like it has to do with politics. It has to do with the philosophy of Canada's, just what Canada wants to do, what it thinks of itself and what the government's role is in people's lives, right? What the public, what the health sector is. What are the, in your experience, did Canada correct its, the opioid, like the oxycodone problem? Did it correct itself? Did it hold itself accountable? Are there other ways in which Canada's healthcare system has gone down the wrong path and then adjusted itself that could prove as a model for how this might go be corrected or moved away from?
The changes that were made, so around 2010, 2012, they started to remove, well, they started to change which Oxycontin was available to people who were on the public drug programs. And I mean, they pivoted a little bit. The doctors pulled back a lot on prescribing, which was good and bad. I mean, a lot of people say that they created that created addiction as well, because it triggered people to go from picking up a prescription regularly to behaviors, as you can imagine, because they're being driven by this very visceral need, physical need, that's of misery that they need to alleviate. So pulling back was something that kind of happened at the prescriber level, I would say, more than anything else. And it was, again, good and bad.
What was the pressure point for that? That wasn't litigation. It was just some sort of regulation.
The pressure point was the colleges, the physician colleges were coming down on physicians who were overprescribing.
Okay.
So they started disciplining people, taking away their licenses, all of that. They've now swung in the complete opposite direction, and they're advocating, college in Ontario is advocating that we should be prescribing whatever opioid is necessary for people, whatever is within our skill set, leave it all to us. So they've gone the other way. There's now no oversight and very little interest in how we prescribe opioids, because the kind of prescribing I'm seeing, people are fearless. The physicians are fearless. They don't seem concerned at all about who's watching or the harms. I mean, but
who's responsible
for Sure.
Yeah, what are the mechanisms of responsibility in the United States? I guess we have litigation a lot.
You also have a very strong federal, you have federal regulations. If anything, I mean, I would normally be in the seat arguing that you guys are, it's too restricted there and you can't look after people. Sorry, that's no, you can't look after people properly with opioid use disorder because you can't get buprenorphine easily prescribed. You can't get, well, you can now, but it took a long time. Even methadone, like there's so many restrictions on how to help people safely get onto a long-acting opioid and then transition to whatever they want. Instead, I think in the States, they push towards rehab where people go to detox. They go somewhere, they get off of everything. They're in this sort of
The short
artificial
acting, isn't it?
environment.
That's the short acting solution.
Yeah, we call it the spin dry. And then they get out and then they're at really high risk for overdose. They're at way higher risk. I don't know if the numbers have been systematically collected, probably
Makes sense.
not, but yeah, they're at it, and we've been trying to cut back on that here by insisting or trying to insist that treatment programs offer to let people stay on their methadone while they're in treatment, because we think, we being me and my colleagues, think that that's the best approach, or to do that treatment, offer it in the community. Unless things are really out of control for people, so they don't leave their community where they're going to be living and coping,
Yeah.
if that makes
So
sense. Yeah.
it's such a one problem that I see also is scale. I just don't know how you scale up good care. I just don't see how you do it without like individuals interacting with individuals. And there's some sort of like rigorous training that the doctors go through, but they are plugged in and responsible for their patients in an individual way. But when you get to public health, it's just so
We have
removed from
models.
that.
We
What's
have
that?
models of care. We have, like, there's something called rapid access addiction medicine clinics, which we now have quite a few in Ontario, and there are some opening up in other provinces as well, where people are can be seen after, like, maybe as a diversion from the emergency department, or they're referred over from the emergency department. Maybe they're seen for an overdose. There's all sorts of really cool, innovative strategies now, usually connected to the emergency departments, where they could take someone who's just overdosed and been given naloxone, and they can then give them buprenorphine immediately and make them feel better so they don't run out back into the street to get more fentanyl.
Okay.
There's all sorts of innovations, you know,
Yeah.
but the money's not going there. The money's going towards handing out tablets and, you know, making the activists, I guess, happy.
Why do
So
you think the money ends up there? What do you think? Hazard a guess.
it looks right. It's been,
Plays well.
there was data. So safe supply could also be injectable opioid treatment. We know there's some data that says that if people go to a supervised injection site and they're given heroin or they're given their opioid of choice to inject, that you can protect them from an overdose when they're there anyway, and you can engage them in care. So this is their first programs were in Sydney and Vancouver. They were very hopeful. People would come here to inject, but then they could also go see a doctor or a nurse or join a group or something. So that was supposed to be the tool. There was early research before fentanyl came along that it was called the Naomi trial, and another one was called the Salomi trial, and they did show that that injectable opioid agonist treatment is a legitimate way to treat people. But now I've lost track of what your question was.
Oh, I did too. I'm just swimming in this
Sorry.
sea of drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, why did the money go? Why do you think
Oh,
the money goes to pills?
well, so initially the narrative
It's very
was
bread and
that
circusy, it just
so
seems like.
safe supply, yep. Safe supply was injectable opioid agonist treatment, which had some data. And then fast forward about mid 2010s, a couple of doctors in a couple of places started prescribing safe supplies, so opioids, to women who were involved in sex trade in order to get their drugs. So some compassionate doctors, a couple of them in Ontario in particular, started prescribing hydromorphone tablets to women who are otherwise basically trying to get money or drugs by having sex. So with strangers, obviously. And someone inherited that practice and went wild with it, and it sort of scaled it up and then started putting out these kind of qualitative studies that said, look how happy people are with this. And people said, yeah, I'm way better now. I'm using way less. Nobody checked to see if they're actually still using the fentanyl or not, but I don't know. Like, objectively, the data's not there.
So what is your tactic? What are you involved in? You say you have a group of colleagues. It's like this little rebel alliance. You guys are trying to
Yeah, it's
develop
a
or
rebel alliance.
educate, or like what's the path for, how do you guys go to scale? Where are you now? Where were you
So,
and where are you headed?
myself and my colleague, I mean, we have initially none of us wanted to talk to the media. Like, if you'd asked us maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago, we were like, we didn't want to talk to anybody because we were kind of fearful that this was very politically incorrect to speak out against this because everybody was talking about this is justice, like this is social justice, right? To give people what they need. How could we deny them that? But eventually we started to see more and more of the fallout from diversion. So patients telling us that they were watching them being, or I could watch somebody sell their bag of pills because some of those patients were using our pharmacy, picking up their pills and then walking out the door and handing them off. Some of the infections, the injection-related infections that I was seeing in the hospital were really hard to handle, like someone developing quadriplegia from injecting and getting an infection in their C-spine. Infections, the spinal infections are among the
Are
hardest.
people
Needing a heart
injecting into
valve.
their spine? Is that
No,
why?
it just there are places where when you inject in there's residue or bacteria or both. There are places in your body that tend to trap that combination of bacteria and residue. One of them is the heart valve, in particular the tricuspid valve. So we were seeing a lot of patients, and they still are. I don't do that inpatient work anymore, but I was working. I started a program in our city doing inpatient care for people who use drugs, and some of the infections were horrible to see, like brain abscesses, like basically just like I said, the injection events are where the problem is. The less injection events that you can get someone to engage in, and teaching people that themselves, like giving them the respect and dignity of saying, this is why I don't want you to do this. Like, I'm not trying to be bossy here. I'm not your dad. I'm just trying to get you to do something safer because I don't want to see you in a wheelchair moving it around with your chin and asking for MAID, which is another conversation that came out last fall, which is like, oh, we can now offer MAID to people with untreatable drug addiction.
Yeah, what's that joke? In Canada, suicide hotline calls you. Sorry.
Oh, I haven't heard it, but it's probably s circulating in the States.
No, yeah, we rib you. I guess
Yeah,
just right there with you.
there's no end. It does branch out. There are
Jesus
so many
Christ.
pieces to it. And what kills me is that people don't realize what it is. So we had a minister up in the, just after an article came out, I might have sent you the link, last year, there was a bit of a fight in the House of Commons between the official opposition and our prime minister. And one of the ministers got up and she started saying things about safe supply. And I got the feeling that I don't think she understood what it actually was. I think she thought it was safe injection sites, which are another conversation about another arm of harm reduction that I have mixed feelings about. But safe supply is just giving out tablets. That can be all it is. It could be more, but it doesn't have to be. And a lot of docs are just, well, if I write this prescription, then I'm being a good doctor now.
That's crazy. We used to have shady white vans. Now you guys have like government vans doing the same thing. Hey, kid, you want to try some Oxy? It's so weird. You just have vans driving around throwing drugs at people.
Well, so the mobile van program is, there are a couple of regions that have that. And I don't think it's that simple, but
It's
it's
like
fairly
DoorDash for
simple.
your heroin.
Oh.
It's like full service up
Okay.
there. Huh.
But yeah, it's a takeover of the language. It's been really hard too, though. Like, I was on a committee that they had a meeting about the terms of reference, and they wanted to remove the words addiction, treatment, and recovery from the terms of reference
They
because
replace them
those
or
are
just
all
leave them?
oppressive words. No, they
Yeah.
just replace them with experience or I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're making it difficult to even talk about and therefore treat, I guess, the behavior, because to judge, I guess I brought it up when I was trying to define your terms about addiction. Addiction is behavior that makes somebody act less and less like a good person, more and more like a bad person, by which I mean I'm not making moral judgments, but their behavior doesn't lead to good outcomes. Their connection to other people start to fail apart, their connection to their job starts to fall apart. Like there's just a bunch of bad consequences. But any sort of judgment of good or bad is oppressive in and of itself. So we can't think about terms of and this is another kind of slippery why I challenged you with the normalization, the humanization, because that can be used too to just completely obliterate any sort of, judgment around what is a good life. And if somebody wants to pursue the good life, then we can give them tools to pursue the good life. But if you take that away and you're just like, well, we can't judge you, then nobody can, you're just limiting people's ability to get the help that could actually benefit them because it's looking at them as not just these feeders that should be given whatever they want under the name of human rights or whatever
Which is
that
not oppressive
is.
at all, right? To sort of impose your values, which is I want to make sure this person is completely free to
Yeah.
have whatever they want, and I think they're not helpable. Well, I find that to be oppressive, to assume that somebody's beyond help, or that I should be able to decide that this person is palliative. Now,
Yeah.
in
We're giving
medicine,
up for you in a way.
Well, in medicine, if someone is palliative, like if they're going to come to the palliative ward because they're to be palliated, you get their consent. So one of the things I've said to some patients is, well, did they get your consent to give you that palliative option of giving you nothing but tablets? Because without the opioid agonist treatment, with just the tablets alone, as far as I'm concerned, it makes no sense. It's
Well,
just
there's no path
basically
out,
either
right?
it's
Is
giving
that what you're
them.
saying? Like, just the tablets will keep you addicted because they're short acting and because of the habits that form. It's a less seedy form of addiction because you're going to the doctor rather than your drug dealer.
Well, they would argue that there's all sorts of toxic contaminants in the street supply. The problem is, most people who are addicted to the street supply will tell me that it doesn't matter how many tablets they get, they have to sell them to get money to buy the fentanyl. So that's the part that we're really upset about, is the degree of diversion that's going on, which is just putting more opioids out into the community, making them more available to teenagers and people who are more vulnerable. People who are already street involved who really need housing. Instead, they're in a tent, and now suddenly someone's going to give them something that'll give them a warm hug through the night. You can see where this is going, like a lot of vulnerability and then that accessibility in combination. So this is our concern, I mean, among others, is that the diversion is really unhealthy for the community, just like OxyContin was in the first place.
This is it's a little too late in the conversation, and now I'm afraid to ask, but what do you mean by diversion? Like you're using that in a very specific way.
Sharing, selling,
Okay.
sharing or selling. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. As I
So,
said, you can get, $25 in one town for 50 cents another town kind of thing.
okay.
Selling it, getting the money, and using that to buy either fentanyl or whatever your drug of choice is.
Okay.
So,
Is there
yeah.
a way for like drug war style tactics of just shutting off supply of fentanyl, or is it too late for that? Is it just not possible?
Yeah, I think it's been said that we're not going to police our way out of this now. We've
Okay.
already exposed a couple of generations of people to opioids, and now we're exposing them to more. I think we have to go upstream. You know, like harm reduction and policing is kind of downstream. We really have to go upstream. Like, what are we not giving youth? What are we not giving people who are in pain, or people who need healthcare, or people who need mental health care? What's happening with housing? I know it all sounds so cliche and boring, but housing is, I can't explain how many people relapse the minute they lose their housing.
Okay.
Because it's so hard for them. Like, I had a woman tell me yesterday, she has to use stimulants all night to stay awake to make sure she doesn't get robbed or raped. And then she'll use opioids during the day when she feels safer and it's bright outside. That's no life.
Yeah. Wow. So you mentioned our, you said something about you guys are wary of being public, but is there an organization? Are you guys collectivizing, or are you coming up with guidelines? Who do you, what is, how can people get
Well,
more information, and where's the momentum going with this?
most of the momentum around this is, first of all, our being like, I'm part of a couple of organizations that are working on different care models. So one organization in particular, we call it, it's called MediFi, which is a based in Toronto out of a hospital. It's really resources mostly for health people involved in healthcare and allied health providers, but I think there are some also some family and individual resources. They're not a lot. It's mostly we've been trying to kind of raise the bar and on what people should expect from the healthcare system for their opioid or alcohol use disorder. And to be clear, alcohol is still killing a lot more Canadians than opioids are. We just would like to see it, you know, not get worse with opioids. But so a lot of it's geared towards alcohol, it's geared towards new innovations. But we're really clear at this point, we're mostly just standing up and saying, no, we need more science. Like, please don't do that. No, don't touch that. Like, wait, we don't have enough science yet to support that. And arguing down when a paper comes out that makes claims, for example, there's a lot of there's a growing body of evidence, and there's 24 papers that support this strategy, but 23 of them are surveys of patients receiving the pills, or, you know, people in the program, or people caring for people in the program who are liked and like being liked. So they have great things to say about the program, or they like that they have a secure job, whatever. A lot is riding. As more money goes into it, more people's jobs are now at stake, including people who've never had a decent job before, and they have lived experience themselves or living experience of drug use, and now they've suddenly got like a job with benefits. They're going to hang on to that. They're going to be pretty angry at someone who comes along and says, you know, I don't think that program's doing great things for the public. So mostly what we're trying to do is suggest, try to meet with organizations and suggest, or not organizations, but like government bodies, and suggest that they be a bit more critical and maybe restructure these programs so that those doses are supervised doses. So if people want 5, 80, 40 or 60 or 80 milligrams of hydromorphone, they can take it in front of somebody. That's different. If it's observed or supervised, that's different. But of course, the argument is that that's oppressive. So it's kind of like it's one of those, it's like ideological clash that doesn't seem to have a solution. But the only thing I wanted to make sure we don't miss is the fact that I do think this could come to the States if it get if it got big enough. Hopefully, we'll be able to put the fires out before it spreads south.
That
But
would be novel. Like, we get your cultural disease rather than you guys, we cough and you get a cold. The other way around happens.
yeah, that it could happen because there's a big gap in the States for opioid treatment. There, as I said, it's been really difficult to make opioid treatment accessible, and someone's going to come in and say, look, this is a disaster. We need to do what they're doing in Canada. You know, it'll be San Francisco, Portland, Seattle. It will be, we need to do pilot programs, and then maybe using the same sort of low quality evidence and promoting it and having the right at the time government to support that, right? And sometimes I like to think that Trudeau's trying to out Biden,
Oh,
like
God.
they're trying to see who's more left, and the whole goal post just keeps shifting farther and farther, and so it's almost like a competition to see who can be more liberal.
Yeah, more progressive, yeah. Yeah. So what got you into this racket called medicine? How did you end up doing this?
I started late. I started medicine. I mean, I went into research first. So I liked science. I was an artist, but I liked science. And I went into science because I was enchanted by genetics. I thought genetics was like magic. And I did an undergraduate degree in genetics, and then I did a graduate degree in genetics, and then I went into medicine. But I didn't have the patience for what we call bench work, for lab
Okay, yeah.
work. You wait and wait and get one result, and it takes 6 months. Whereas now I get tons of results in one day just by seeing people in a room.
Yeah,
It's like,
huh.
love it.
Are you, it's all public practice up there? I don't really understand. Like, we have a lot of
You can be paid different ways depending on where you're working. But it's all, people have a health card pretty well. It's very hard to see it, find a situation where someone's going to get charged or have to pay to receive any health care. It's all taxed. It's becoming very burdened. It's not working really well. It's getting worse, especially in family medicine. So we're supposed to be the quarterbacks. And less people are choosing family medicine as a specialty for all sorts of reasons. It's sort of not my area of expertise to really
Yeah.
understand what's going on, but I know it's not considered, it's now become dominantly female. It's not considered as desirable, doesn't pay as well, can be quite thankless, can be quite challenging. It's hard to keep up with everything to be a
Oh, yeah.
generalist. And I mean, I love having a niche now, but my first few years in practice, I did rural medicine. So I was like country doctor driving
Yeah.
around delivering babies. And I love that.
Wow.
I still do a bit of that in the Arctic. I still go up to small communities and work with
Dr.
a lot of
Quinn style,
Indigenous.
just around passing out
She was
herbs.
better looking, but yeah, I guess so. It's hard to shake that. I was just up in a remote place in December, and I really like it. I like the Arctic. It's beautiful.
Wow.
Gorgeous.
Huh.
So, but I do addictions work up there. Like I do training with the doctors and nurses up there and the residents up there as well. So I think like a huge part of our country needs better training. We forget that a huge proportion of people who go to the doctor or go to the hospital are there because of something related to alcohol, nicotine, opioids, cannabis. Like they're responsible for a lot of what we do with our system.
Okay.
So, yeah.
What's the takeaway here if somebody's wrestling with addiction, I suppose, or seeing addiction rear up in their family? Like, I guess it goes back to that humanizing. Like, how have you found it helpful to perceive of this and then to work oneself up to getting treatment or getting off of a dependency?
It's a good question. And I say it's a good question because depending on who you interface with first, you can get really different stories. Sort of like with a lot of things we've talked about or you've talked about with other guests, you can see one person and they can affirm your opioid dependence with safe supply, and you can see another person and they can try to challenge you and say, well, is this really what you want? What is it you really want? And I think when people are struggling with whether it's opioids or alcohol or something else, that it's not easy. It's not going to be easy to get better. It shouldn't be that easy. If it's that easy, it's probably not right. It needs to be challenging. You have to feel challenged. And it has to sometimes feel uncomfortable to go
Why is
through
that important?
recovery.
Why do you think that's important?
I think it's human nature. I mean, I think this is sort of the roots of, well, I think I was listening to Stella O'Malley talking about anxiety with Constantine the other day, and it's we're taking that away from people. We're not accepting that anxiety or pain or suffering is part of being human.
Or even
And
ambivalence.
even ambivalence, absolutely. Ambivalence has to have its place as well in addiction care and addiction treatment. And it's not ever going to be easy. It wasn't, I mean, it was maybe in some ways people can have fallen into their substance use, but to get out of it, it's not going to be easy. But easy is not what they should be looking for. It's really about setting a goal and then maybe smaller goals and achieving those smaller goals and feeling good and gaining something called self-efficacy. So feeling like, oh, I did it. I could do that. I could do that, you know? And that comes with a bit of discomfort. Like, I don't want to jump out of a plane and I probably never will. But if I
Well, you went
did,
to
yeah, I
Antarctic,
know.
so
No,
who knows
but
what's
I
going to
mean,
happen?
no. Yeah, right up north in the Arctic. But if I did, I would then feel like, oh, I could do that again, right? But I'd probably like wet my pants, you know. So there's got to be discomfort. We all have to have discomfort. We do suffer. We're humans, and to take that away from people is to take something away from them. Like, you know, it's stealing something, and it doesn't feel right to make it too easy.
Oh, Lori, such an educational and philosophically satisfying conversation. I don't know what's going up in Canada. I love keeping tabs on you guys. I went to Bible college up there in 1996, I think. So up in the middle of Saskatchewan, Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, just in the middle
Oh
of
yeah.
nowhere.
I was probably there as a kid in the back of a station wagon, you know, kind of thing.
Oh, really?
You drive across Canada and you're in the back of the station wagon with the dog. Yeah.
Yeah,
That's probably
that's
when I would have
what
been
you were
through
doing?
Prince Albert.
It's I have a lot of camaraderie for Canadians themselves, and also it's just an interesting kind of canary-ish place for whatever reason. Canada's decided to kind of be a test site for a lot of these different kind of ideas, more and more liberal ideas, it seems like, and attitudes, and then government structures or government behaviors. And we see, okay, well, can the government get away with shutting down bank accounts of their political dissidents? Or can't they?
Right.
So it's really
When can they
important.
get away with that, right? It's not a question of can they, but when, which conditions, and who decides which conditions will allow that? Yeah, I hear you.
So is there how can people follow your work and watch you get dunked on Twitter? Because some people just derive satisfaction from that. That's kind of an addiction too. Like, oh, look at
Well,
somebody's getting mocked.
I've actually been trying to like dial
Taper
down on
off.
Twitter a little bit,
Is there a
but
slow acting social media site that you use to swap out your addiction?
that I used to swap it
Yeah, like podcast. That's like slow acting social media as opposed to Twitter, which is the
Oh,
fast acting social media.
No, I don't have any podcasts. I do have some colleagues with great podcasts, but that's all related to, you know, more of the field. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Gypsy, which is apparently a racial slur, even though I have actually Gypsy descendants, but and Jewish descendants.
Descendants. So you're just sitting there like popping out gypsies and Jews?
descendants, descendant ancestors. Sorry. Yeah, you're right. Got it wrong.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, I was accused at some point. The same activist coming after me about safer supply were coming after me, accusing me of that. And it's like, that's been my moniker for a long time. You know, it goes back to my grandfather and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, but no, aside from Twitter, I'm trying not to spend too much time. I do find it like there's other things that are really a lot more important where I want to put my energy.
Do you have a book in the works, or have you written a book, or is just these? Yeah, you no, yet,
No.
no. Okay.
Why you think I should?
Yeah, why not?
I have a few in my head, but I haven't even thought about turning them into anything. So
Okay.
yeah.
Well, I just planted a little
But
seed
I
in
might
there,
work
maybe
with, I have a
someday.
couple of like favorite colleagues, one of them being Carrie Mendoza, and she and I and Lisa Littman have talked about a few cool ideas related to opioids and, you know,
Yeah.
other touchy topics.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll probably write something, but it won't be a book. Like it would just be like, you know, an article or something. We all
Okay.
have to be like the stars have to be aligned for us to all be unbusy enough at the same
Yeah.
time, you
Yeah.
know? So
Yeah.
we'll
That would
see.
be a power trio, the
Yeah.
three fates of the medical industry kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to be like the poster child of like harm reduction, fighting harm reduction. Like that just doesn't go down, right? Because I don't want to fight harm reduction. I just want to change the meaning of it. I might
Yeah.
not be powerful enough to do that.
Well, or align or push things towards. Yeah, the activists, the only reason the activists win is because nobody pushes back against them, and they use tactics to make people cower and seem like lesser than them. But you have every, I mean, you kind of have a responsibility to save people from the activists in a way, insofar as the activists are
Yeah, we
screen
can
using it
interpret
too.
the data. Like that's our superpower, right? I mean, not that I'm like a brilliant person. I have people I rely on to help me to interpret some of it, but being able to go through a paper and criticize it, I think is a power. It should be. Hasn't been considered. It's been considered, you know, quite the opposite, but absolutely. And that's what I rely on myself and my colleagues to do, is to really challenge what we think is ideologically driven rather than evidence driven.
It's happening all over.
Yeah, it
Ideology
is.
is it's really it's quicker than evidence. We know that much.
And trying to teach it and sort of propagate it to learners as well, because you know, I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. I need to make sure somebody else is thinking like
Carries the
this.
torch. Yeah, for sure.
Or I could fall off a boat, you know. The Drake
Wow.
Passage.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you do put yourself in harm's way. So talk about harm reduction. Physician, heal thyself, right?
Yeah. That
Well,
link I'll just send to you, but I'll send you the other links for the podcast.
yeah,
So
pile them up. I'll
it's
put
not
them down
relevant.
in the
Okay, you
description.
can decide what's good. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you
All
so
right.
much for your afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
My
It's
pleasure.
great to have
My
someone to
pleasure.
listen.
Yeah, no, it's great to listen. Love it.
Take care.
Have a good day.
Bye.